we mentioned stalkers on this podcast before. We talked about a couple of people who were stalking Taylor Swift.
Yep.
I think that might have been it, but there are...
There's the dude that killed John Lennon.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, he was
a little
stalker.
Bit of a stalker.
And Bjork, that's on our Patreon.
Yeah, we did her.
Her creepy stalker guy, but he killed himself.
Maybe. I don't remember that part. I remember the stalker story, but I don't remember a lot of the specifics.
He was the guy who ended up filming all of these videos of himself, remember?
Oh, I remember the videos, yes.
Yeah.
Some of them.
And so he committed suicide and had a video. It's sent a video of it or something. I don't know.
I don't think he sent the video.
He didn't send
anywhere.
The video because he would have died. But he sent something to somewhere, yeah. And then they got that and were like, where the fuck did this come from? And then found him and then found the video he took of himself. I don't want to give the whole thing away.
Right.
Go to patreon.com/deathbypodcast.
Well, I'll have to do that because I don't remember now.
I know.
I remember part of it.
I only have room a while ago. For the previous 10 episodes in my brain. And then once those happen, all of the other ones are gone again. I've been discovering so much shit just putting our old episodes on Patreon. I'm like, I fucking forgot we even talked about that. you mentioned one the other day.
I don't even remember that.
In the hallway out here, you asked me, didn't we do an episode? It was on Jimmy Page and if he had, he bought Aleister Crowley's house.
Oh, yeah. And we did do that episode.
I didn't remember that we did that episode, but you asked me about it, and I was like, good thing you asked me today, because I just put that shit on Patreon yesterday, and I didn't remember doing it at all.
And I don't remember why
you
I
don't
remembered
remember
that.
Asking me.
I don't remember what made me think to ask that, whatever I was looking at.
You were talking about Aleister Crowley for some reason. I don't know.
Oh, I was telling somebody about Aleister Crowley, and I don't remember why.
Well, it doesn't. I'm sure everyone's tired of us
not
sitting here talking
shit
about how we don't remember anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could probably stalk us. We wouldn't even remember why we're supposed to be scared.
Right.
Please don't stalk us, though, honestly. Well.
Welcome to the show, folks.
Yes. Are you stalking us? We might have some stalkers. I think I heard Jono's in the closet.
He's masturbating furiously.
It's a good thing that he lives in Australia.
Right.
Did you introduce us?
I don't remember. Strangely enough. Oh, welcome to the show, everybody. This is Death by Music Podcast. getting off on the right foot here. My name is Jake, and I'm here with Alex, obviously. And we're like three up. This is our third episode in that we're recording tonight, and we're kind of losing it a little bit.
Honestly, I like the energy. Right. I'm like, fuck it. Let's record three more. I'm usually so tired and over it by the time we get to recording after work that I'm like, oh my god, we have to record.
Right, I'm over it before we even start.
Luckily for me, today ain't nobody at work. It's spring break, so I just left early.
Oh,
I left at 2:30.
Well, that's must be nice.
It was nice. Thank you. Maybe that's why I have so much energy. I came home and I ate a fucking early dinner. I feel good. I'm feeling energized.
All right.
I had two pickles.
Two pickles.
Not whole. No. Well, I guess it was half a pickle.
So then, all right. You
it's
had
two pickle
two
spears.
Pickle quarters.
But I feel like that's what's giving me the energy. Anyways.
It's a lot of energy in that pickle juice.
Fucking electrolytes, man.
There you go. Yeah, you got to drink some of that if you get drunk and get a hangover.
So good.
Just get you a jar of pickles and just chug it.
Yeah, butt chug it. This is from uberrock.com. Oh, no, it's .co.uk. Sorry, British people. God, I don't mean to shit on British people all the time, but fuck them, right? No, I'm just kidding. let's bounce back and forth on this one, too, because it is a list. Today we're talking about rockers and their stalkers. So stupid.
It's a great name. I like it.
Yeah, there's a handful of these that we've already talked about, so I wonder if we should just read over them for anybody who's new, maybe. We'll just read them anyways.
However you want to do it.
Yeah, let's just fucking read them anyways.
And this is written by Jason Daniel Baker, and it came to us on a Sunday, the 9th of February in 2014 at 3:30 a.m.
Yeah, that would be a.m. Okay, so Brian Adams, Chester Bennington. Oh, we did talk about Chester Bennington's stalker. Chris Cornell, Sheryl Crow, John Frusciante.
There we go, folks.
Michael Jackson, Avril Lavigne, Courtney Love, Ozzy Osbourne, Gene Simmons, Eddie Vedder, and Zakk Wylde are among popular rock musicians who have been inconvenienced, if not outright terrorized. That's quite a It's quite a difference there. By Star Stalkers after finding a foothold in the music industry and in popular culture. Some would say the phenomenon of celebrity is an inseparable part of the price of fame.
I would tend to agree with that. There's probably way more stalker stories out there than we are aware of.
Yeah, I was trying to find, like, the whole reason why I came to this is because I was reading about how Axl Rose had a stalker woman who, like, went to prison or jail or something, and then she violated that and was thrown back in, and I was trying to get more information on it, but it was really hard to find anything. I even found the fucking court documents, but I couldn't, like,
from the local
no like
courthouse website.
There's
or?
Like a website, I forgot what it, Trellis or is that it? There's some sort of website where you can look up court cases, and I found it on there, but I couldn't click on any of the, like, documents that were filed and stuff. Anyways, years of couch surfing usually follows for a musician just beginning. Your typical band will play in front of an ant farm if that is the only audience they can. What the fuck is this person saying? I'm not going to read that, any of that.
When you first start out, you have no audience. You'll play for an ant farm if that's who's at the venue to listen to you. It's like the Ramones. There were like three people there when they first started.
True. Android Division. a dream of a full stadium of admirers is part of what keeps a lot of them going. Then positive encounters with those first few fans they get, which align their dream with reality, can also embolden the artist to keep doing what they do. Oh my gosh, that's so true. When does it cross the line between fan and fucking obsessed? A fan can sometimes steal a few extra moments with their favorite band by manning a merch table or helping move gear. Dude, this is calling out some people I fucking know.
You turn into a roadie at that point.
Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones was known to let the occasional teen fan hanging around outside his flat come in and do a little housework for him.
What else are teens useful for?
Slavery. It made his life a little easier, but also gave those fans an unforgettable experience being around their hero. A lot of musicians have stories of communicating with fans like that. But after years upon years of success, overexposure, and privacy lost, a fatigue in dealing with people can set in as a thousand different things compete for a star's attention. Some fans collectively and individually comprise a pain in the posterior for an artist wanting privacy. Other fans present more serious concerns as the reach of the artist expands into popular culture where any wacko can focus and fixate upon them. How the fuck did we not mention Selena when we mentioned people with stalkers? Because the woman who killed her...
Yeah, that was her fan club president.
Yeah, fucking stalker, though.
Yeah,
but somehow infiltrated her circle. It goes beyond the first tier, i.e. nuisance of inconvenient people like paparazzi, journalists, process servers, salespeople, and hangers-on making demands on the time the star used to have an abundance of, but no longer does. As determined as some of them might be, people like this can be dissuaded with slight difficulty or relative ease, depending on how patient the star is or how well they are managed. The next tier are those that at some point had a personal or professional connection with the star and are looking to reconnect. This can range anywhere from a childhood friend, schoolmate, ex-bandmate, one-night stand, fellow rehab group inmate, right on down to a barkeep in bumfuck middle of nowhere who threw a stranded musician a $20 bill to help him or her get home. The celebrity tunesmith might not want to renew any of these types of forgotten acquaintances for the same reason any of the rest of us might want to.
Right.
Yet the upper tier, the true stalkers, have something which sets them apart from the above two. The true stalker can't take a hint, even if it is the form of a restraining order. This specific group is rare, but nevertheless gravest concern. They have profound mental illness leading to elaborate delusions. Such delusions can segue into violence. Many of this tier think the musician they are fixating on is communicating with them telepathically or via secret messages hidden within song lyrics or album cover art, press releases, interview answers, etc. Dimebag. The illusion of intimacy can... Wow, I thought came into this thinking we didn't talk about any fucking stalkers. Like every episode we've ever done. the illusion of intimacy can build, derived from anything that appears to establish commonality when in fact it signifies nothing more than coincidence or misinterpretation. Good old-fashioned eccentricity, though, is not, in and of itself, a defining indicator of a true stalker. One false case speaks volumes.
All right, David Bowie... and a big pink bunny rabbit. During his 2004 North American tour, rock legend David Bowie found himself trailed by someone in a pink bunny rabbit costume seemingly everywhere he looked.
Very specific.
Yeah. Makes me think of those people that dress up like clowns and stand under streetlights just randomly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say furries.
Those two. perhaps seeing a rather ingenious absurdist take on Alice in Wonderland Bowie, a rock and roll showman who had played various colorful characters on stage, began to go along with the gag as the 5'3" rabbit appeared at multiple concerts of his. When it boarded a plane he was on, he was evidently surprised.
Someone let a person board a plane in a bunny suit?
I mean,
maybe it was a onesie.
I don't think there's a rule against that.
I don't think you could wear a mask.
It could be one of those onesie hoodie
things. Yeah,
that's
just me assuming that it would be a masked thing. I don't think you can wear a mask through TSA.
No.
Unless it's one of the sickness masks.
Yeah.
But they still make you take it off at some point, I think.
They got to see your ID and all of it. Yeah. Bowie talked about it numerous times, including Ellen DeGeneres' talk show, and never seemed to feel at all threatened. Often he expressed more than mild amusement. It turned out to be Isabel Gunn's of Vancouver, Canada, a super fan who late in the tour was invited on stage during a concert, given a tambourine, and allowed to perform with Bowie's backing choir. Bowie's appreciation was unexpected. He had been tight with John Lennon in the 1970s, but even before Lennon was murdered in December 1980, Bowie privately expressed fears of being attacked on stage.
Oh, that's right. We did talk about that.
Mm-hmm. But the idea of his being stalked by a giant pink bunny was blown out of proportion by overzealous media without regard to the feelings of the artist and his superfan. Guns, a harmlessly eccentric Vancouver goth chick who supplemented her income via sales of homemade soap. You know what? At least she's clean, right?
Yep.
Also circulated a syndicated indie music sex advice zine entitled Lollipop Shoved Up My Ass.
Wow.
Interesting. So how would this playful and adventurous woman qualify as a stalker? As unique as she may have seemed, she didn't fit the stalker mold for numerous reasons. Following a tour is not stalking. She was not known to have imposed herself on Bowie or done anything inconsistent with any other true Bowie fan, other than, you know, wearing a pink rabbit costume everywhere. Guns also attended gigs of many other artists, acquitted herself commendably, and is one of those fans who can make a musician feel special by her enthusiasm. So what is a stalker? Let us examine some known examples, beginning with the most obvious and dangerous.
Beatles legend John Lennon was murdered on December 8th, 1980, outside his New York City apartment building, shot 4 times in the back by a lone gunman, a soft-spoken, overweight, bespectacled religious fundamentalist named Mark David Chapman. A gun in the hand of someone who felt angry and powerless proved to be a very dangerous combination, but in the United States, it is a right. Ooh, this person. Shots fired from UK.
I was about to say,
oh,
they're down from America.
Not shots fired, knives thrown across the water from UK. The 25-year-old American misfit Chapman fit the definition of weirdo for a lot of people, but not the profile of a potential killer, at least not back then. Raised in an abusive home, bullied as a teen, tormented by suicidal thoughts, and with a brain further damaged by drug use and heavy drinking, he took then lost a job as a security guard in the years leading up to the murder. In New York City, in the days leading up to the murder, Chapman was far from alone in stalking out Lennon's place of residence, the Dakota on Manhattan's Upper West Side. There were multiple fans who were not a threat to themselves or anyone else, hanging around hoping for a glimpse of their idol. They were part of the scenery. Earlier in the day, Chapman was photographed as Lennon personally signed his copy of Double Fantasy. The eventual killer was seemingly like any other fan up until he wasn't.
That's such a wild photo, too, if you guys ever want to go look at it. It's just go listen to the... Is that... That's on a regular feed, right?
Yep, we did a full episode on...
Go listen to that episode. It's interesting.
Was that season 3, I think? We did an episode on John Lennon or 2.
What are we on, 6?
Yeah.
3, 4, 5.
It feels like it was halfway away.
I didn't realize I've been on that many episodes.
Yeah.
But yeah, go back and listen to it if you haven't.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
You've been on more than you are our Rob Trujillo. You've been our bassist for the longest time.
I'll take it.
Yeah, go back and listen to our John Lennon episode or episodes. I think it might have been two parts.
Yeah, it was.
It is evident that Chapman saw two reflections of Lennon, leader of his favorite band and composer of his favorite music, but also as possessor of an ego that caused the Beatles to split up, that denigrated his own legacy and that of the band, refused to reunite with former bandmates, and disregarded the manner in which lyrics to his music appeared to contradict how he lived his life. To Chapman, Lennon was a hero turned villain, and nothing he saw of Lennon in New York City in the days leading up to the shooting contradicted his perceptions. Lennon was known to be quite gracious with fans, and witness accounts suggest he was that way with Chapman. Herein illustrates the line between fan and stalker. An autograph and a few moments of FaceTime will usually satisfy a true fan. A true stalker demands considerably more. In Chapman's case, the ultimate price was involuntarily extracted. From that shocking moment forward, rock and roll, and by extension, the complexion of modern celebrity changed. The only famous people who tended to get publicly murdered up to then were criminals and politicians. A fan turned assassin? That didn't add up. For Lennon in particular, it was unforeseen. He had lived in New York as a solo artist from summer 1971 until his death. His hassles were mostly with the American government and President Nixon, who was trying to deport him. In his final TV interview, he stated that fans didn't approach him very often and that he and Yoko went pretty much wherever they wanted to. One of the most memorable moments in the Lennon documentary, Imagine, shows him talking to a young and probably high fan who had come to his estate in England and lurked around the property. Lennon met with the kid and very patiently explained to him that there weren't any hidden messages in his songs and his music was just personal expression and a bit of occasional wordplay. At the end of the conversation, he invited the interloper into his house and fed him, a noble gesture which indicated naivety. Accessibility and lack of security have to be considered as factors in his death. Lennon's bandmate George Harrison was nearly murdered. We also fucking talked about this. In December of 1999, by a stalker who broke into Friar Park, his Henley-on-Thames mansion, which was surrounded with high security walls. Harrison was hospitalized with multiple stab wounds, as was his wife Olivia, who purportedly tried to subdue the attacker, 33-year-old Scouser Michael Abrams, with a fireplace poker and a heavy table lamp. The would-be murderer, a schizophrenic former heroin addict, claimed to be on a mission from God and believed that the Beatles were witches. They would be warlocks, idiot.
Right. Oh, good point, yeah.
Unlike Chapman, he didn't have a gun.
How do you know that?
I don't know.
Fucking nerd.
It's because...
it's because you spent 16 hours in the fucking movie theater watching Lord of the Rings.
Yeah,
extended version.
Honestly.
You're an expert now.
You still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man. I'm trying to get them on there.
Look,
we all artists, man. You feel me? We gonna have this like
me and my man Kai, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now.
This
I gonna lie, we play with this shit right now for I gonna lie.
Don't play with it, take that shit serious.
Oh my God. No, I didn't spend that long because I did fall asleep in the middle, remember?
Oh, okay.
Helm's Deep. So boring. whether choice of weapon would have made a difference is open to conjecture. Lack security and his illegal entry into Friar Park has been looked at as a contributing cause to the nearly lethal result. Harrison was already dealing with the inconvenience of another stalker late that year. A woman named Kristen Kelleher had broken into his Hawaiian estate in Maui. Stalkers are often known to break into a star's house when the star is not there. Some stalkers are known to make themselves quite comfortable while there. Since some popular music stars in multiple residences, and most tour, those residences can provide convenient shelter to an obsessed fan.
Hmm.
Fuck that. Sir Paul McCartney, who wrote the stalker anthem, You Won't See Me, for whatever reason, has had little publicized trouble with stalkers. In fact, Sir Paul has usually been very assertive, though polite, about expressing disapproval when his boundaries are violated. It may have made all the difference. Whether he made a conscious decision to try to mute any media attention a hypothetical stalker might get is unclear. Actually, I looked at his Instagram today, and he posted something about Beyonce. She covered his song Blackbird. He was like, oh, I loved it. Thought it was great. Love Beyonce. And all of these women in the comments were like, Paul McCartney, marry me. you're my husband. And I was like, bro, you are aware that you're posting this on like a public forum, right? You look like a fucking crazy person.
Yeah.
It was very strange. Let's see. Poor Ringo. Nobody gives a fuck about him enough to stalk him. No, just kidding. Oh, that is what it says. As for Ringo Starr, evidently stalker interest was never very high. Well, that's good for him, though. While revered amongst even the most distinguished of fellow drummers, the general public, including Beatles fans, tend to view him as an iconic mascot for an employee of the Fab Four rather than as the great musician he truly is. Honestly, I would say that they're fucking... We did an episode on Mal Evans, too, who was their, like, roadie. And I would say that he was on that border of being a fucking stalker because he was obsessed with the Beatles. He saw them performing when they were, like, in Germany or whatever. Uh-huh. And he was working security. And then he was like, please, let me work with you guys. And he got in. And then he documented everything. Like John would hand him a piece of paper and he would be like, John handed me a piece of paper today. And he like very closely documented all of these interactions, everything that was going on in the studio, wrote it in his journals. And then those journals have now been published. So he's just one of those people where they're saying like, oh, they're so obsessed with the band, they become the merch guy. Mm-hmm. Like that was that guy for them.
Yeah.
So that guy probably was stalking Ringo. So don't worry, Ringo. Point. You did have a stalker.
Yeah.
All right, next.
another, you know, at least he's got person. his Ringo cock rings or whatever the fuck they were.
Yeah, the Ringos. Yeah. Somebody we did a mini episode on that.
Yeah.
The cock ring novelty sex toy.
Yeah.
Named after Ringo. Paul McCartney doesn't have one of those.
That you know of.
He might.
You'd
actually
buy it.
Ew. Let's just move on. This is another full episode that we've done. So if you like where this is coming from, well, fucking go back and listen to season whatever. Season 3. Season 2. Season 2?
It was before me, yeah, so it was
season
1 or 2.
Season 2.
It might have been 2.
It might have been 1.
Yep.
I don't remember.
Yes, the senseless death of Dimebag Daryl Abbott. Groove metal god Dimebag Daryl Abbott was shot to death on stage during a concert at the El Rosa Villa Club in Columbus, Ohio on December 8th, 2004. By ex-Marine semi-pro football player Nathan Gale. Three others died, and seven more were wounded in trying to stop the attack before Gale himself succumbed to a 12-gauge shotgun blast at the face from cop James Niggemeier, which literally blew Gates' head off in front of an already shocked concertgoers.
Imagine
that's a little more violent than I recall hearing.
No, we talked about it.
Yeah,
I just imagine like how traumatic that would have been for people in the club to see four people die, seven people get shot, and one guy's face get blown off.
Right.
Yeah, fuck that.
That's something you kind of just bury and don't ever think about again, I guess. I don't know.
Until it's super late at night.
And you're by yourself. A longtime fan, the hulking 6'3", 19 stones. I don't have 19 stones. I have to go out in the yard and figure out how much
that weighs.
Yeah.
Probably 250 pounds.
Probably. But yeah, probably 250 to 300. Let's hit the old Googler up.
Stone. 266.
There you go.
Bitch.
Nice.
I'm good at British. Because I learned from that guy, that
at
fake
the, at
British.
At the
yeah.
Zozo show, right.
Fake British guy.
So Gale was angry that the brilliant guitarist and his brother Vinnie Paul had dissolved their former band Pantera and was evidently less than enthusiastic about their next band, Damage Plan. I remember those guys.
Then why'd he go to their show?
Delusional in the extreme, which he would have had to be in if he didn't blame vocalist Phil Anselmo for the end of Pantera. Gale also purportedly believed that Pantera had stolen his music, was known to pet an imaginary dog and talk to walls. Other than illustrating the frustration in the minds of some stalkers at the autonomy of the career creative decisions their heroes make, it also shows that a stalker rampage can have considerable collateral damage, especially when the assailant has had military training. The military, for its part, was unable to successfully treat Gale's psychosis before discharging him, inadvertently unleashing him on a suburb of Columbus a year before Damage Plan visited on tour. A musician can carefully plan an itinerary to avoid the media, fans, and, of course, random psychos, as well as known stalkers. But playing live is a different thing, and it is a necessary thing for most of them. What Nathan Gale did beyond the human tragedy is take from other fans the privilege of deciding whether Damage Plan Live was something Pantera's fans would love.
All right, next. Squeaky calls upon the Laird of Bolskine. I don't know saying any of those words correctly.
Sounds like some Lord of the Rings shit to me.
Manson family acolyte Lynette Squeaky Fromm is alleged to have stalked Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page during the band's 1975 North American tour. She submitted a note through a band intermediary she hoped Page would read in March of that year, which was later purportedly burned, unseen by the legendary X-Man. I'm an X-Man. Squeaky would come to be convicted of attempting to assassinate American President Gerald Ford, an attempt made in the late summer of that same year. Her Manson family associates, of course, had a notable track record, which had plunged Hollywood into a paranoid frenzy in the summer of 1969 for their gruesome ritual murder spree, which they had inexplicably drawn inspiration for in the Beatles' White Album. Did Squeaky really stalk Page? Stalkers are not usually as easily dissuaded as Squeaky was, though it sounds as if a particularly diplomatic band or record company employee who intercepted her handled things well, protecting his employers from a potentially dangerous encounter and unpredictable repercussions. Squeaky also potentially faced unpredictable repercussions if you believe the groupie folklore surrounding Led Zeppelin while the band was still together. Going by that, she could have gotten either a beating, a whipping, or a shark meat pap smear for her trouble had she hypothetically managed to find her way into their presence.
What the fuck is that? Shark meat? I understand shark skin is...
No, they did a thing once where they put a fish into a girl's pussy.
Uh-huh.
So they're basically saying she... So it's a good thing she didn't pursue him further because she could have ended up like that girl.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because the things that they did with their groupies were like real sketchy.
Huh.
The things that the groupies were like, sure, go for it. Sounds fun.
All right.
Former Zeppelin singer Robert Plant's own obsessed fan Allison Billings purportedly began stalking him as well. As he was well into his solo career in 2010. Dang, it took 3 years before a threat assessment triggered his request for a restraining order in May of 2013. The alarm bells went off in reaction to the darker tone of her fan mail, in which she cited jealousy about his romance with folk recording artist Patty Griffin. Plant maintains he has never even met Billings. She claimed to have been in a relationship with him.
That's a bit extreme there. Yes, a stalker's attention can shift from target to target. One of the most notorious of alleged rock star stalkers is Karen Jane McNeil, who is said to have harassed Axl Rose, a singer of Guns N' Roses. She just showed up one morning in late April 1995, illegally entering his house whilst he was playing guitar in the kitchen, as one does.
What?
She purportedly had traveled all the way from Ohio again. In answer to his psychic call. Rose's brother, Stuart Bailey, reported having turned her away from the front gate a couple of days earlier.
So she's just hanging around.
Her illegal entry into his Malibu house would be repeated in multiple violations of a restraining order. Her disappointment in not receiving red carpet treatment was expressed most acutely in one of her many letters to him, in which she spoke of belief in the afterlife in the following Kurt C., as in Cobain, in quotations, it says. He'd been dead for a year by then. A key thing in identifying stalkers is, of course, persistence. She spent time incarcerated for repeatedly hounding Rose over the years that followed, which resulted in prison correspondences sent to him. Given Rose's history of violent outbursts, any sane woman would have counted herself lucky to have emerged from her adventures without having been beaten unconscious. Wow.
Well, this author is hilarious.
Yeah, but she did outweigh Rose by about 4 stone.
Okay, so she could have taken it.
So Axel's just a tiny bitch then. In March 2009, Lars Ulrich, drummer for Metallica, filed for a restraining order in Los Angeles Superior Court against McNeil. Holy shit. Oh, this is the multiple targets. Yeah. Okay. against McNeil to keep her 150 yards in American football field and a half away.
That's so nice of him. Yes.
Thank you for extending, you know, using our measurement system.
I know how
to describe what's going on here.
Yeah. Well, he said yards. It's not like he said 150 meters and then was like, yeah. Oh, that's a football field and a half. But I do know, like, it is a good measurement.
Right.
I get it.
So, yeah. So in America, you have to stay a football field and a half away. That's basically what it's saying.
Right.
From Metallica. Their families and those who administrate the Metallica fan club. It remains unclear what McNeil did to prompt such a precaution.
Probably the same shit.
But yeah, right. Justin Timberlake would later do the same thing in October of the same year, claiming McNeil kept showing up at his house and refusing to leave.
Man, she's really playing
she's
the field.
She's getting around, but she's getting the money for that. Some might read into the fact that McNeil shifted focus from Rose after the release of Chinese Democracy, the much-anticipated sixth Guns N' Roses studio album, a bizarre concoction which sounded like a chalkboard struck in a wood chipper at various points and stray cats getting their freaks on alleyway at others' Chinese Democracy annihilated a lot of people.
So he's saying that because this album sucked, she stopped.
She just kind of gave up and went
she
after some other people.
She moved on to the next. Hey, that's a compelling argument. Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
Axl Rose was like, this bitch is in my house. Like, how do I get her off of my tail? And somebody was like, just come out with a shitty album. And he was like, all right, bet.
Right.
And then she left him alone. All right, Danzig, not only nice guys get stalked, according to musician/comic book mogul/pro wrestling aficionado Glenn Danzig's bodyguard, Russ McKay, discovered a guy lurking around Danzig's property and trying to break through the front on Halloween 2005. After giving chase and finally catching up to the guy, McKay was unable to apprehend him but was able to pry away the guy's backpack. It was discovered that the would-be intruder's backpack was full of porn mags with photos of Danzig's face superimposed onto naked bodies, both female and male.
Nice.
So he's going to show him? Look at my art. a journal was also found in the backpack with the words, "Kill Danzig," written under the date October 31st. Dude, you're just making it fucking easy for them.
Right.
This was explained in the periodical LA Weekly. The sordid summary horrified and disgusted many, including me. I never once doubted it was all true. Danzig, characteristically known for bluntness, was initially reticent about the incident in interviews. He would later dispute this account and say it was the result of a miscommunication without going into detail. He's not known to have ever mentioned any hypothetical stalker activity widely in the past, other than perhaps alluding to it in very general terms. Whether Danzig has ever even had a real stalker would detract credence from much I have written in this article about why stalkers might target specific musicians. Danzig doesn't make time to pretend to be a nice guy or even to show the requisite common courtesy of a pit viper. What stalker can project fantasies of kinship with this dude? We'll probably never know. What most of the dribs of information we have gleaned from the past, from the most well-publicized cases of stalking tells us, is that the truly dangerous stalkers are a pretty small group. What is not readily apparent is how they select the people they obsess over. Wow. That was a big-ass article. I'm going to have to look more into this guy's shit. I like him. Yeah. If you were considering stalking us, please don't. I know it's different with us than it is with musicians because we're actually talking to you.
Are we?
We've had multiple people who are like, I feel like we're friends and we're talking to you.
Oh, that's that whole
parasocial relationships.
There's an actual name for that.
Yes, parasocial relationships.
But I've had that, you know, I've listened to a few podcasts and they're really good. And then you're sitting there. You kind of feel like you're a part of it. And then you feel like you could contribute to the conversation, something.
You might possibly get along with those people, but then you have to remember when you meet them that they have no fucking clue who you are. And even if they do, like, they don't know you like that.
Right. And they don't remember the episodes that you're going to go. It's like meeting somebody from Star Trek. Like,
when you go up and you make like an inside joke about some episode and they're like,
I don't remember that at all. It's one of those type of things.
Yeah. Yeah, parasocial relationships are one-sided. One person extends emotional energy, interest, and time, and the other party, the persona, is completely unaware of the other's existence. Most common with celebrities, organizations, such as sports teams or television stars. Looking at you, Mike, fucking stalker ass. No, just kidding. He's our bodyguard. Although he did start off as a fan. I met him because he listened to, I'm assuming, my old rock. I used to have a show on a rock station here. And then I had a metal show on a different station here. And he's just been there for like every part of that. And I remember the first time I met him was at one of the other rock stations, like, shows.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't really realize. I mean, I was familiar with all my listeners' names because I did interact with them a lot on Facebook and get requests and stuff.
Right.
So he was like, "Hey, I'm Mike." And I was like, "Oh, shit. You're that guy." Never knew what you looked like. We took a photo together, and I still have that fucking picture. Put it on my radio page, and I was like, "Look at me with all my fans." But
look
now,
at me with all my fans.
But now I would consider him a friend because we see him at every single show. Like, we met up at Pantera, and we hung out with him. Yeah, he's like a homie. So, if
that one worked out.
If you're gonna do it, be like Mike. Don't be fucking creepy.
Just be friendly. So I don't know how that works.
And take a shower. For the love of God, please bathe. Because if you don't bathe, there's absolutely no chance that you are going to be our friend. Thank you, and rest in peace.
Later.
Get out of the bushes. Death by Music podcast is written and produced by Alex Motler, Cassie Gardner, and Jake.